I have a secret, friends, and it's so joyous I can't keep it to myself. And it wasn't actually a secret in the first place. It springs from the words of that Saint Mary Oliver. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk for 1,000 miles repenting. You only need to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. So as we enter into worship, put away the pressures of the world, pressures that ask us to perform, to put on masks, to put on brave fronts. Silence the voices that ask you to be perfect, for we have had enough of those. The love contained within these walls does not depend on you being braver or smarter or stronger or better. Better than you are in this moment right now. The only thing you need to do, the only thing you must do, is bring the gift of your body here, no matter how able, your seeking mind, no matter how busy, your animal heart, no matter how broken. Bring all that you are and all that you love to this hour together, and I just know that revelation will abound. Come, let us worship here together. When the founder of Hasidic Judaism, the great rabbi Israel Shem Tov, saw misfortune threatening the Jews, it was his practice to go to a certain part of the forest, light a special fire, and say a special prayer. And each time he did this, misfortune seemed to be averted. God intervened to help him. Now, generation after generation of rabbis who took his place in the Hasidic tradition would still see misfortune happening. And so each of them, in turn, tried to go and recreate this ritual. But each generation seemed to lose a little part of the story. One generation lost where in the woods to go, but it was still okay because they had the fire and they had the prayer. The next generation, well, they didn't exactly know how to say the prayer, but they could go into the woods and light a fire to somewhere. Well, generations later, it fell to the rabbi Israel of Razin to overcome the misfortune threatening his people and his generation. Sitting in his armchair, his head in his hands, he spoke to God. I am unable to light the fire. I do not know where in the forest to go, and I do not even know the prayer. All I can do is tell the story of going into the woods, of lighting the fire, and saying the prayer. And my hope will be that it will be sufficient. And it was. And misfortune was averted. Now, this story didn't make total sense to me till maybe Friday evening, when I visited the iconic Fort Collins establishment, Totally 80s Pizza. So this is a pizza shop on College, which is basically a museum to the 1980s. John Waters, Alf, the Terminator, Big Hair, Light Bright, all of it. If you haven't been, it is a pilgrimage to go on to. And I didn't go there because I have any deep connection to the 1980s. In fact, I was only a fetus for 3.5 months in the 1980s. I didn't even go there because, well, I just went because I didn't want to cook, and it was the closest place to my house. But when I got there, what I realized is that most of the people in the joint were in their 40s and 50s, and they had brought their children. They had grown up in the 80s. And here was this weird vortex of 1980s memorabilia. And I saw them walking with their kids and pointing to the different objects and explaining to them what that cyborg is that looks like the former governor of California. or why there wasn't a hairspray shortage in the 1990s. What I saw was the story being shared across a generational divide. They didn't need to go to the 1980s. The story was sufficient. This month at Foothills, we are exploring the theme of story, because our lives are made up of stories. The stories we tell about who we are, really, how the world works according to our foggiest of perceptions, even the fictional stories in which capture reality in a deeper way when they add magic or dystopia. Stories write our lives as much as or even more than we write them, because they are this human attempt at connecting the chaotic nature of life into a meaningful arc. So this month we're going to be exploring what does it mean to be a people of story. And we're inviting all of you to share in this journey with us. Each week we're going to have a testimonial from one of our congregation members responding to a weekly prompt. But it's not just them that does all the work. Karen's like, yes. Because we're inviting all of you to join in. This little insert in your order of service is your invitation to engage in this story project, because we want to hear your stories, and we have a lot of ways for you to do that. You can record them by calling a number. You can write us an email and send us your stories, and each week we're going to give you a different question, and we're going to collect the stories, and we're going to share them back to you so that we can all benefit from the wisdom of our stories. Does that sound interesting? Does that sound like something you're wanting to do? Yes. Awesome. That's the right response. Also, every Sunday after services, Lindsay, who maybe you want to wave, is going to be helping us record stories, our own little story core. So if you find her in the social hall, you can go and record your version of the story, which will be shared out to the whole church community. This week's prompt, this week's question is, when did someone very different from you change your story? I'm going to invite Karen Janicey to come and share a bit of her story.
When I was asked if I would do the chalice lighting on this particular Sunday, I knew immediately why I was chosen. I'm a liberal thinking UU like you. I see the world as a complex web of alternative perspectives. It's rich with diversity of all kinds, and I relish the intricacy and the muddiness of this. Meanwhile, my husband, of almost 25 years, holds passionately to a staunchly conservative worldview. He upholds the letter of the Constitution, not current interpretation. He wants to keep danger at arm's length. He prefers absolute clarity about gender identity. And he's pretty sure that he's right about most things. I, on the other hand, am rarely convinced that I have the answer. So what is that like? How can I hold a story about life that is so different from my husband's story? And how do we manage a shared story? Perhaps you have someone in your world who's like this, a family member, a friend, or someone you're not so friendly with anymore because their views are so opposed to your own. So for a minute, let's look at this question. How do we live together daily with such different worldviews? There are two parts to my answer. First, we really love each other. We have a basic human bond. We cry together at the same sentimental scenes in movies. We laugh together at the crazy antics of our young grandchildren. Like the moment last week when our 9-year-old granddaughter, whose family's about to move to a new house, said, "I can't move. I just got used to the spiders in my bedroom." Laughter binds us, as does crisis. I've walked many hospital corridors for my husband as he underwent various treatments for 3 bouts of lymphoma. He was there for me with comforting hugs when my cousin threatened to fire me and my brother demoted me in our family's corporation. It's true that on a daily basis, one of us will make a comment that will irritate the other. We don't have a perfect handle on this, but very deep down, we connect. And that allows us to not just tolerate our different visions, but to appreciate them. I do suspect that I appreciate and he tolerates, but who's counting? So how did I grow that appreciation? Years ago, when I first heard his views on government, welfare, and more, I was very quiet. I avoided discussion completely. Since I was sure I couldn't change his mind, I thought, why bother? This went on for many years. But when I joined this church almost 4 years ago, something in me changed. And here comes the second part of my answer to how I can live with someone whose worldview is so different from my own. As I opened myself through many sessions here to deeper listening among you, I wanted to hear more about how my husband came to have his views. I wanted him to have the chance to talk to me about them. I was learning to listen more lovingly. The questions I was now asking were not only good for him, providing him an audience for his thoughts. They released the pressure that I've been feeling, that need to be quiet. I know as Unitarians that we care enough to lovingly ask questions of those whose worldview competes with ours. What is the story behind their opinions? The more we understand that story, the more gracefully it can live side by side with our own. As we listen more deeply, I believe we love more deeply. Now, here we are facing election week, finally. This may be a very teachable moment. Whether your candidate wins or loses, there are people we can each reach out to and listen to. People that didn't vote the way you or I did. We know that deep down these people are just like us. They are caring, loving, longing for what is best in our world, but with their own unique story. So I'm going to light our chalice today for this amazing opportunity that we have this very week to connect and heal wounds, both ours and theirs, an opportunity for truly unleashing courageous love.
Sometimes it can be hard to love one another, don't you think? Sometimes we hear things or see things, and it can be hard to remember how or why we should love every single one of those others. And so I invite us to start our prayer this morning with a call for grace. The grace that breaks through and opens our hearts and reminds us that we are all one. The grace that helps us feel that connection, that sense, even across our deepest divides. That sense that there is nothing that can keep love from doing its work. And so let us rest for a few moments in that love. A love that is bigger than all of us, yet present in each of us. A love that can heal us beyond all understanding. We pray that we might be partners with this love, that we might be its hands, its voice, its witness to this weary world, or that it might show up in us when we're weary, surprising us and calling us home. We pray for receptivity, openness, that we might be awake to love in all its surprising ways, whatever may be blocking it, let us release that now. Whatever bitterness may be in our hearts, we release that. Whatever fear or prejudice, old anger or regret, we let it go. Let us find together a new courage, a new hope, to together here in this space, as we hold one another in all our many joys and sorrows. There is love all around. And so for all that we have and all that we are, let us keep giving thanks. The world is so beautiful, and there are so many people filled with so much goodness who keep showing up, who keep offering a new story, a changed story. And so we keep saying thank you. Thank you. For we are all in this together. So let us keep breathing into a sustained courage, a steadfast love, and a faithful hope. Let us feel the love that holds us. Feel ourselves as partners. And remember the grace. We don't have to do this alone. There is so much more going on than we can even see. And so let us do what we can and let the rest go. Feeling all the partners. Keep breathing. I light our candle as a light of hope. Through this few days ahead and the weeks ahead, may it be a light of hope and love for us all. Keep breathing. Keep loving. Amen. Blessed be.
One day there was a seagull in the San Quentin prison's yard. A bunch of the inmates were gathered out there. It had been raining, and so the seagull was enjoying plodding along in one of the puddles. One of the inmates picked up something, doesn't matter what it was, and was about to throw it at the seagull, when the hand of one of the other inmates reached out to stop the man. Of course, this escalated the man's anger. Who the hell did this guy think he was? Why did he care so much about some blankety-blank bird? Everyone started circling around them, just waiting for the fight. The other inmates were yelling at the man, "Why'd you do that?" And out of the man's mouth came these words, "I did it because that bird has got my wings." Everyone got it. It simply stopped their minds, softened their hearts, and then there was just silence. Jarvis Masters, the man who stopped the projectile, is an African-American man currently an inmate on death row. During his time in prison, Jarvis has taken vows and has become a member of the Buddhist order and has also become an acclaimed writer in the Buddhist community. Not what you might expect. But I think the most powerful actor in the story is actually the seagull, right? I mean, through the story of a common seagull flying away, Jarvis and the other inmates experience this vicarious liberatory movement, rooted in their experience of interdependence, where for at least one moment the reality of their incarceration was erased. The freedom of the gull was knit into the very story of their being, adding to that alchemy of Jarvis's story of being incarcerated, black, Buddhist, and now a free, soaring gull. Each of these true, but each of them not enough. One of the stories that is true, but not enough to understand who I am, is that I am a millennial. That generation of people who range in age between 18 and 34, And there are now more of us than any generation in history, so watch out. We are a generation who has never known a world without the internet, and who came of age when two planes hit the two trade center towers in New York. Being an oldest child, and most of the time being 13 going on 50, there have been moments in my life in which I felt a tad disconnected from my millennial peers. And when the selfie craze began, I was the first to jump on the hater train. And a craze it is. Between 2013 and 2014, the usage of the word selfie has increased 17,000%. 17,000%. How many of you have taken a selfie before? Confession time. For those of you who don't know what a selfie is, the best way to explain it is probably just to show you. So, a selfie is a photo that's taken of a subject by the subject for the purposes of sharing online. So you guys better smile to turn this around. All right. Are you smiling? Got it? All right, just a sec, I have to post it. All right. I would tag all of you, but that would take forever. All right, so I'll say Facebook. Come on. Phones these days, you know? All right. At Foothills preaching about selfies. The first row didn't know. Ask me in coffee hour how many likes we got. So part of the rise in the selfie is a technological innovation. So if you think about it, most cameras now are also cell phones. Right? And although self-portraits have always been a genre of art, they have now become accessible to nearly everybody with such ease. And if millennials don't relent in their selfie taking, it's estimated that each of us will take about 25,000 of them in our lifetimes. It's fantastic. So what do you think, though? Do you think this is emblematic of a self-involved narcissism in our culture? Everyone's like, yes. Or a beautiful embrace of the self as both creator and subject in the new technological milieu. So a few years ago, I was on the fence, so I decided that I needed to try this whole thing out. So I challenged myself. I was going to take a selfie every day for 30 days. 30 days, 30 selfies. Then I could say I tried it, I didn't like it, and I could stop engaging with the whole mess. So, lucky you. These are my first two. They got a lot of likes, but what I realized is that it was really awkward. I was playing with angles, I was making funny faces. Really, I wasn't ready to share with the world the part of myself, or the deeper part of myself, or maybe a more true part of myself. I was sort of putting on a mask and playing with it. But you know, it wasn't as bad as I thought, because I could just edit out the ones that I really didn't like, and I didn't have to post them. And people started to respond. They sent me notes saying that they felt connected to me, that they look forward to my next photo. And as the month went on, I got a little bit more comfortable with being me, someone who's a little bit messy, somewhat wacky, but all in all, a just normal guy. Now, a note here is you may not be able to see it, but I almost didn't post this photo because I have a zit right above my eyebrow. Now, I don't know if anyone noticed this but me, But you know, what I realized in that moment was like, that was me. In that moment, I did have a zit in my eyebrow, and I could cover that up. Or I could just step into that and share it. I realized for me, selfies were a way of saying, I was here. This is who I was today. And this day, I was very frustrated because I was conjugating French verbs. So after 30 days, after 30 selfies, all different, yet all actually very much me, I've actually continued my selfie taking. And I started to find a joy in the dissonance between the me who has no idea how cars work, and so when our car battery died at the emissions test center on I-25, this was my only contribution to the situation. And the minister that I feel called to be. This is after Trump surrogates talked about how if he's elected, taco trucks would be everywhere. So I said, come on, taco trucks, this sounds awesome. I contain multitudes. I've begun to believe that the process of selfie taking, of showcasing to the world who we are in any given moment, even just who we were in that moment, is a process in which we begin to make space for the deepest of our stories to emerge. Yet the vulnerability is real. When we think about sharing a part of our story with others, we fear sharing a snapshot of our lives, our broken, our messy, our dissonant, our joyful lives, fearing that in that moment, that moment in time will become immortalized, will become our portrait. That is what people will be remembering us by if we share this part of our story. Forever freezing others' perceptions of who we are, were, and could be. If we share, so why would we? But our lives are not made up of a singular story, as much as we might want to assume. You are not just your childhood trauma or your awkward teenage years. You're not only your privileged background or your impoverished one. You are not only the status granted to you by your work. Neither your greatest accomplishments or your most disastrous failures, your best days or your worst days, define your story in totality. The story that society tells about people like you, your highest dreams, your deepest aspirations, the pain in your body, your mind, your soul, the cancer deep inside, the lie you told about who you voted for, or the secret that you refuse to let out. None of these things make up the totality of your story. Just like no matter who wins the election on Tuesday, will not make up the totality of the story of this country. They are momentary selfies that form a larger mosaic. Nothing but myself, myself's, Adrian Rich writes. After so long, this answer, as if I had always known anger and tenderness, myself's, and now I can believe they breathe in me as angels, not polarities. Anger and tenderness, the spider's genius to spin and weave in the same action from her body anywhere, even from a broken web. Our lives are not unidimensional fairy tales, easily wrapped up nicely after just a few pages. Being human is living with a story that most publishing agents would send back for revisions with the note, this doesn't seem to have it all together, try again. In Ateo Cavino's book, Invisible Cities, he imagines a conversation between Marco Polo and the great Emperor Kublai Khan. But which of these stones is it that supports the bridge, Kublai Khan asks. The bridge is not supported by one stone or another, Marco answers, but the line of the arch that they form. Kublai Khan remains silent, reflecting. And then he adds, "Then why do you speak to me of the stones? It is only the arch that matters to me." Polo answers, "Without stones, there is no arch. Each selfie a stone. Each moment of selfiness, when we showcase to the world a glimpse of the story of our lives, a stone. In that moment, if we risk, if we dare, we add yet another stone into the archway of our lives." Writer Elizabeth O'Connor reflects, "If I respect the plurality in myself and no longer see my jealous self as the whole of me, then I have gained a distance I need to observe it, listen to it, and let it acquaint me with a piece of my own lost history. In this way, I come into possession of more of myself and extend my own inner kingdom out." Suppose we come to know that every recognition of anger and jealousy and greed and sloth is an opportunity to lift out of the waters of unconsciousness a tiny submerged piece of land. That bird has my wings. My selfies are not my portrait. My story is more than just one moment. Only in the long view, when we take a step back and gaze at all of the moments, all of the stories, all of the selfies, all of the bricks, are we able to gaze, catch a glimpse at the underlying narrative, the story of our lives, and the stories of any group of people. To hold onto one part of the story as if it were the whole cuts you off from every other part of your being, not allowing those submerged stones to rise from the surface, stymieing the revelation of you to yourself. There is a gentleness that we are all invited into when we become librarians of ourselves, pulling on those white gloves as we receive each moment and file it away according to some internal Dewey Decimal System. It is only after we welcome each story back that we can gaze at the shelves and see the patterns of the stories that have emerged that tell of the currents of your life. We can take that long view, seeing the currents who are emerging from the thousands of data points, and not just this one feeling, just this one election, just this one moment. "Ask me," the poet William Safford writes, "sometime when the river is ice, ask me mistakes I have made. Ask me whether what I have done is my life, and I will listen to what you say. You and I can turn and look at the silent river and wait. We know there is a current there, hidden, and there are comings and goings from miles away that sometimes hold the stillness exactly before us. What the river says, that is what I say. Ask me whether what I have done is my life, and I will listen to what you say. We know there is a current there hidden. My prayer is that we are emboldened with the tenacity to live out our momentary stories as if they were true and valid, that we would become free from the concerns that they will become our immortalized portraits, that we will cherish the searching of our hearts as we look upon the collective stories of our lives, and that as we search for that current in which our lives has spoken, may each of us, may our nation, find grace in that larger story. Amen, and blessed be.